from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The U.S. is threatening more sanctions against Iran for both the familiar claims against its nuclear program and alleged rights violations, and now a new one, for this century at least, Iran's alleged ties to terrorism. Press TV's Omar Leski reports.
The U.S. has threatened Iran with more sanctions, both over its nuclear program and the alleged rights records. This comes as the U.S. and the other members of the P5 plus one group are holding talks with Iran over its nuclear energy program.
We are approaching these talks seriously and with our eyes wide open. That's why, as we negotiate, we continue to enforce sanctions on Iran, not affected by the joint plan of action. Not just, incidentally, over its nuclear activities, but also because of its support for terrorism.
Kerry told American senators that Washington could impose economic sanctions if Russia and Iran moved forward with their planned oil contract. Under the contract, which is yet to be finalized, Russia will buy 500,000 barrels of Iranian oil per day in return for selling goods to Iran. Kerry said the contract would violate a November interim nuclear deal reached between Tehran and the P5 plus one group. He added that the deal would also trigger more U.S. sanctions. Tehran says the sanctions are illegal and wants them to be lifted. Iran has also rejected as baseless the rights violation allegations by the U.S. and the EU against it.
Iran and the six world powers will hold the next round of negotiations in Vienna on May 13th. The latest two-day negotiating session was the third in that city this year. Participants said all important issues were discussed, and a July 20th deadline has been set for a final agreement. On Wednesday, it was mum's the word at the UN about a report that Sudan expelled the head of the UN's Population Fund office in Sudan and accused her of interfering in domestic affairs. One reporter who spoke with Stephanie Dujarric, the spokesperson for the United Nations Secretary General, seemed frustrated with the apparent wall of silence about the claim.
Can you confirm that the UNFPA representative Pamela Farge has been thrown out of the country? And can you say, the government has said that she has been. What's the UN side of the story and what's your response
to it? On the second part, yes, we're aware, and our colleagues at UNFPA have asked that the questions be referred back to them.
I did ask them, and they said to expect something at noon. So
ping pong. No, I don't mean to say lightly, but
sure.
We were waiting for some guidance from them. I haven't received it as I walked in.
Sudan's foreign ministry said on Wednesday that the official, an American, was, quote, asked to leave, closed quote. A military spokesperson said, quote, she was not abiding by the country's laws and she was interfering in the country's domestic affairs in a way that is inconsistent with her status as a UN official, closed quote. He added that the move, quote, has nothing to do with the UN agency whose missions and programs are very much appreciated by my government, close quote. Khartoum suspended activities of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Sudan on February 1st, similarly accusing it of violating guidelines for working in the country. Russia is raising questions about reports that more than 100 mercenaries employed by a successor to the infamous Blackwater firm are on the ground in Ukraine, tasked with suppressing resistance to the coup government in Kiev by the Russian ethnic majority in the east and south of the country. RT's Gayan Chichikayan reports.
In a span of less than 2 months, we've seen Washington go from cheering for protests with takeovers of government buildings in Kiev to exactly the opposite, now trying to help Kiev quell the uprising in the eastern part of Ukraine. Moscow has accused the U.S. of sending mercenaries disguised as Ukrainian Special Task Police to crack down on protesters. On its website, Greystone says it's providing various security services. Details are nowhere to be found. Greystone is known as a mercenary firm that the U.S. government hires for specific operations, with secrecy as its major suit. The firm has denied its presence in Ukraine.
It has an independent capacity in the sense that it's an independent business. That gives it the ability to plausibly deny any allegations and allow the U.S. government to say, we don't know.
Greystone was founded by Eric Prince, who also created the infamous military contracting firm formerly known as Blackwater. Blackwater received hundreds of millions of dollars to protect U.S. personnel in Iraq and Afghanistan. The mercenaries became known for their recklessness. In one incident in 2007, a group of Blackwater contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqi civilians and wounded 20 others at a square in Baghdad. No one was held accountable.
But we have to recognize that this leopard cannot change its spots. It is the same beast. And it's a predatory organization. It's accountable to no one. It works in the shadows. And as a consequence, the people of the world have to fear them.
Because of the bad reputation Blackwater has gotten from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, its management has rebranded and renamed the firm several times. It was called Z Services at one time, and it was from Z Services that Greystone split off 4 years ago. Some lawmakers are pushing the Obama administration to arm Ukrainians.
I want to know, and I think the American people should know, and maybe most importantly, the people of Ukraine should know, why won't we give them some defensive weapons?
With respect to arming and providing assistance to the Ukrainians, the fact is that we are currently working with Ukraine to determine their requirements across the entire security sector.
Some carefully worded statements by Washington to keep the extent of its operations in Ukraine largely unknown. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chakyan, RT.
Meanwhile, another U.S. military ship is set to be deployed to the Black Sea amid the Ukrainian crisis. The U.S. Navy destroyer Donald Cook will join the USS Truxtun, whose stay in the waters bordering Russia was extended to, quote, conduct drills, close quote, with Romania and Bulgaria within a week. This according to U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Derek Chollet, who spoke at the White House Armed Services Committee earlier in the week. He also said that the Pentagon has been maintaining senior-level defense dialogue with Ukrainian officials since the outbreak of the crisis. That was echoed yesterday by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. The Donald Cook is capable of firing SM-3 missiles, which allows the ship to function as a part of the Aegis ballistic missile defense system. It is normally deployed in Spain as a part of the U.S. Missile Shield program in Europe. The vessel is expected to dock into a number of ports along Romanian and Bulgarian coastlines and bring some additional 175 U.S. Marines to the Romanian coast, as was announced last week by the Pentagon. The Marines are a part of the Special Purpose Marine Air Ground Task Force Crisis Response Force. While the additional Marines will officially be part of the force normally based in Spain, they are set to be based in Romania, where they will join nearly 300 Marines already in that country. U.S. officials insisted that the purpose of the additional deployment of another ship was done, quote, primarily to reassure our allies and partners in the region that we're committed to the region, closed quote. This is the fourth U.S. warship to visit the Black Sea since February, a practice that Moscow has heavily criticized in the past. Last week, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that Washington was in violation of the Montreux Convention, which regulates the number of ships that can enter the Black Sea. Lavrov said the convention, quote, gives extremely clear criteria limiting the deployment of warships not belonging to the Black Sea governments in regard to tonnage and length of stay, closed quote. And while U.S. forces seem to be massing near Russia's western and southern borders, on the east, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel was in Beijing discussing a number of what his office called difficult issues with Chinese defense officials. We have this from the Chinese television news agency, CCTV.
A highly symbolic sign of closer U.S.-China ties. After all the tough talk with the Chinese counterparts during his trip to China, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel met with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
We have attached great value to your visit. I wish your visit will help advance the new model of military-to-military relations.
Xi Jinping said the frequent high-level exchanges between the two sides will guarantee that the relationship heads in the right direction. Hagel's trip to China mainly focused on clarifying policies about the U.S. pivots towards the Asia-Pacific region and developing the new model of military relations.
It will require bold leadership that seeks to deepen practical cooperation in areas of shared interests. while constructively managing differences through open dialogue, transparency, and candor.
China sees the core of this model as avoiding conflict.
The competition between China and the U.S. is not a zero-sum game, nor is it containment. Instead, the two sides should review relations from a new perspective and work to open up a cooperative situation with win-win results.
But Hagel is one of the few American officials who has openly criticized China while visiting the country. He urged China to solve maritime disputes using international law and make its military intentions more transparent. China and the U.S. have overlapping interests in the Asia-Pacific. The U.S. hopes to keep its dominance, while China has been adamant about its sovereignty rights.
On this issue, we will make no compromises or concessions or trades. Not even a tiny bit of violation will be allowed.
Hagel has called for practical cooperation between China and the U.S. and greater personnel interaction. To demonstrate, he went to a PLA logistics school for non-commissioned officers in suburb Beijing. It was the first time the school has received a U.S. defense secretary. But as a former sergeant in the U.S. Army, the defense secretary is accustomed to talking directly with the enlisted soldiers. And he brought this experience to China, sitting down to dinner with some Chinese cadets. These young soldiers could be future commanders who Hagel believes will play a crucial role in U.S.-China relations.
Hagel's visit in China has been marked with unusual straightforwardness on differences. His hard tone during the talks may reflect growing U.S. concern about China's intentions and development. And he raises more questions than solutions. All this and the facts of the China-U.S. confrontations is exactly why it's vital for both sides to keep the dialogue going. Hanbin, CCTV, Beijing.
More details on the failed U.S. attempt to create a Cuban Twitter designed to promote unrest and ultimately a toppling of the government in that country. We have this from RT's Guyan Chichikayan.
An investigation by the Associated Press has revealed that the U.S. government has once again tried to steer protests in Cuba by creating a messaging network which was designed to become the Cuban Twitter. The social network based on text messages was launched 4 years ago and was called Zunzuneo. Now at the time, nobody knew that the program was conceived in Washington and carried out by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The Associated Press investigation reveals that that extensive efforts were undertaken to conceal the true nature of Zunzuneo using offshore bank accounts, front companies, and overseas servers. The AP quoted a 2010 memo from a contractor involved in the initiative as saying, "There will be absolutely no mention of United States government involvement. This is absolutely crucial for the long-term success of the service and to ensure the success of the mission." The mission being Cuban Spring, of course. Apparently, the idea was to create a service that would carry neutral content at the beginning, but once it gained enough subscribers, that's when it would be used for political purposes. The AP quotes another document saying, "Mock ad banners will give it the appearance of a commercial enterprise." You can't see any of it now because the program was shut down 2 years after its creation. Not clear exactly why. Some sources have said because of lack of funding or maybe because of lack of efficiency. So there are still questions. At its peak, though, the network had around 50,000 subscribers. And for a while, many unsuspecting Cubans kept guessing why their new free messaging service stopped working all of a sudden. Oh, yes, by the way, apparently the initiative also appears to have had a surveillance dimension to it, according to the AP. Contractor Mobile Accord began building a vast database about the Zunzuneo subscribers, assessing their quote-unquote receptiveness and political tendencies. Well, now that these subscribers know who was really behind the service, the White House says they were not trying to dupe anybody at all. They were just being, quote unquote, discreet. Here's Jay Carney saying, "Of course, the government has taken steps to be discreet, but this is not unique to Cuba. U.S. officials will argue there's nothing wrong about facilitating communication, flow of information. It's all protected under free speech. Fair enough. but there is a fine line between informing people and fomenting revolutions in order to align certain states with your interests. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chakyan, RT.
Those concerned about the role that big money plays in American politics and ultimately the U.S. government got some more bad news last week when the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of McCutcheon versus the Federal Elections Commission, removed yet more of the paltry remaining regulatory scheme once called campaign finance reform laws. Jody Armour is a professor of law at the University of Southern California. He discussed the case and some precedent cases with Radio VR's Andrew Hiller.
At the heart is the proposition that power in a democracy has to be accountable to those affected by its exercise. That's democracy. When power in any form, not just in the state, we'll get to some of these discussions, I think, later when we're thinking about election reform and contribution limits and the like. But the idea behind democracy is power has to be accountable to those affected by its exercise, and therefore all those affected by its exercise should have some voice in that power and what's done with it, how it's applied. And we have to expand our notions of democracy more and more so more of those people who are affected get a voice. But it was blacks, Civil War, women, the fight for the vote on their part. We have this constant march in the direction of greater democratic control over our lives and over the nation's history, but we're far from there yet.
Now, I like the image you provoked, the image of a march to the right to vote, simply because if I think about an army and I think about an army marching, every so often that army has to rest. You can't march forever. And every so often, because of natural barriers or an enemy, the march has to retreat. It has to go backwards a little bit. So when I look at the landscape of the march to vote today and I think about the voter ID laws, or I think about hanging chads, or I think about various other things that have been coming up, I wonder, where are we? Are we in a forward movement? Or are we in a place where we're trying to go backwards?
Well, we are in a tug of war between those two different directions, Andrew, and you see the Supreme Court is getting involved, the court systems are getting involved, the legislature is getting involved. The legislature, for example, is passing federal election law that's trying to govern who can participate and on what terms they can participate. The court is coming in and saying, well, legislature, you may want to expand democracy or protect the integrity of democracy, if you will, but we want to protect certain other interests too, the interest of property owners, and make sure that they continue to have a very strong voice in political decision making. So it depends on how you look at it, Andrew. You know, we don't have clear white and black hats, perhaps as we did 100 years ago when you had chattel slaves or just a flat denial of women, you know, of the right to vote or serve on juries, et cetera. But It's a more subtle kind of argument now. The ground has shifted some, but it's still the same old debate of who among the people who are being influenced or affected by power have a voice in the exercise of that power. You know, that we keep coming back to that question, and you can see it going in both ways today. Sometimes the court has been on the side of expanding the franchise. Other times the court, as today arguably after Buckley, Vallejo, and Citizens United, and McCutcheon, arguably the court is in the process of limiting some of the democratic power of ordinary people and protecting that of corporations and property interests. So it's interesting, Andrew. We're kind of all over the place, and it gives us a chance to see the tug of war going on right under our noses.
And so then we get to the issue of influencers and the Supreme Court. And you've already brought up McCutcheon, which is the key one that has just been ruled. First, tell us what the argument over McCutcheon was and what the ruling was.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got to go back to understand McCutcheon. You really have to understand Buckley Vallejo. Okay, Buckley Vallejo came out after in the early 70s, so to the middle of toward the mid 70s. And it tried to impose, after Watergate, after the scandal of Watergate, and after a real concern about the integrity of the electoral process, The legislature stepped in and tried to impose contribution limits, expenditure limits, and disclosure requirements. And they implemented all of those. They rather passed that legislation. When they tried to implement it, there was an appeal, and the Supreme Court said, you cannot put caps on expenditures. You can put caps on contributions. You can require that contributors disclose their identities so we know who's giving money to what causes, but you cannot cap expenditures because, and here's the key move, Andrew, because expenditures, money, is speech. That was the momentous move. When the court said money is speech, so when you're putting limits on the spending of money or the contributing of money, you're actually limiting free speech. You're impinging on free speech. And so we're going to engage in a searching scrutiny of whether you have a really good reason for impinging on this free speech interest. And they said, you don't have a really good reason when it comes to expenditures, at least a good enough reason to put a caps on free speech in the form of expenditures, but you do have a good reason when it comes to putting a cap on free speech when it comes to contributions and, of course, disclosures as well. So that was the big move. Then Citizens United came along. We got to just deal with it just before getting to McCutcheon. Citizens United said, you know what? That elimination of caps on expenditures, that applies also to corporations as well as to individuals. You can't cap the expenditures of corporations because that's capping their free speech as well. So we're going to treat corporations like people. We're going to treat money like speech. That's where we are when we get to the end of Buckley and Citizens United. In comes McCutcheon, and McCutcheon says, you know what? We said up to now, even if there is a free speech interest involved in money and contributions, expenditures and disclosures, we're going to say when it comes to contributions, there's a compelling state interest in limiting the amount of contributions because there's an unseemly appearance of quid pro quo corruption that goes on if you allow contributors to give vast sums of money to particular candidates and then those candidates seem to go out and make decisions that are favorable to those contributors. It has the unseemly appearance of influence peddling. So to get rid of that, we're going to allow, the court said, we'll allow the legislature to put some caps on contributions. Well, in comes McCutcheon and says, well, we're going to start telling you, even when it comes to contributions, that you can't put too many limits on what people can do when it comes to contributing their money. And so they can contribute money in the aggregate to many more people than before after McCutcheon. We're not going to put any limit on the number of people that they can contribute to. Yes, we're still going to put limits. McCutcheon still leaves limits on how much you can give to a particular politician at a particular time, but it allows you to spread the wealth a lot more to a lot more politicians on the contribution end, and we see that as protected by free speech. And so what we have now is a Supreme Court who is saying we're going to be interventionists. And someone like Clarence Thomas is saying, and I think Scalia is ready to go along with him and others, we need to get rid of all limits, political finance, campaign finance, at all, approach it all as free speech, and really give capital and property a voice in the democratic process that is outsized, in a sense, but it's an important way of protecting those property interests. So that's where we are now, Andrew. We have a clash between democracy and property interests, and we're trying to see how far the democratic principle can extend into the economy and how far economic logic can extend into democratic institutions and democracy.
Recent stories in the national media have once again brought to the public eye the longtime collaboration between the Reverend Al Sharpton, one of America's best-known street activists, and the FBI, the very same agency that many activists know as the perpetrator of the infamous project called COINTELPRO, the program designed by former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to disrupt activist organizations and cause dissension among, and in some cases kill, black activist leadership in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. The recent stories about Sharpton's collaboration with the FBI are nothing new. Newspaper articles in the 1980s had detailed his involvement with a task force overseen by the FBI and the New York Police Department, but the widely publicized disclosures have left out an important aspect of Sharpton's documented collaboration with the police and FBI, the experiences of scores of movement activists whose paths have intersected with his over the past 40 years. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford attempts to fill in some of the blanks in Sharpton's career with the following commentary.
Al Sharpton is a crook who is always for sale. This is not an opinion, but a fact that is known in great detail to scores of movement activists whose paths have intersected with this talented but totally amoral hustler over the past 40 years. I personally watched him sell out the campaign to elect Jersey City, New Jersey's first black mayor, whom Sharpton had pledged to support in 2001. Sharpton's price to sow confusion among black voters was a mere $5,000. This was only one of countless career transactions by a man whose self-proclaimed role models are the entertainer James Brown and the boxing racketeer Don King. Sharpton has sold out black New York City many times over through his well-compensated service to billionaire Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He sold out black children and the institution of public education in a bizarre, multi-city, salt-and-pepper tour with arch-racist Newt Gingrich on behalf of school charterization. The 2009 Sharpton-Gingrich Traveling Show, chaperoned by Education Secretary and Obama basketball buddy Arne Duncan, marked Sharpton's rise to made man in the Obama organization, a pit bull primed to maul any political dissenters from the first black president's corporate agenda. MSNBC, the corporate megaphone for the Democratic Party brand, provides Sharpton the kind of media platform that substitutes for independent black political leadership in the 21st century. Reverend Al is what he always wanted to be, a celebrity locked in the embrace of the rich and powerful. Sharpton will reach what will probably be the pinnacle of his phenomenally corrupt career on Friday in New York, when the annual convention of his National Action Network will host President Obama, Attorney General Eric Holder, Sharpton's traveling companion Arne Duncan, and Agriculture Secretary Tim Vilsack. If Sharpton were part of a genuine, independent black political movement, the occasion would be an opportunity to confront the president on his global offensive against peace and world order, his militarization and destabilization of Africa, and his plans to step up the pace of the global economic race to the bottom through a new wave of NAFTA-like trade treaties. The convention might challenge the Attorney General to explain why Wall Street banks are too big to jail, but any American can be imprisoned without charge or trial under a system in which the law itself is a secret. The National Action Network delegates would be allowed to ask why black people in Detroit have been disenfranchised with the acquiescence of the Democrat in the White House, and how did it come to pass that President Obama became the greatest deporter of immigrants in U.S. history. The Agriculture Secretary could explain why the administration seemed positively happy to sign a bill that wipes out billions in food stamp benefits to the poor. But none of this will happen at Sharpton's convention, because everything he does is an act of prostitution. In the presence of such monstrous corruption, recent confirmation that Sharpton was an informant for the FBI's campaign against Italian mobsters in the early 80s seems very tame indeed, except that it also tends to confirm other allegations that he tried to rat on black radicals during the same period. But today, Al Sharpton is at the top of the political garbage heap, the administration's go-to guy in the sewers. He is King Rat. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.